what's up? This is Tajay of the Mighty Souls of Mischief crew. I'm chilling with my man Festo, my man A Plus, and my man Oak. You know, he's dope. And right now, you know, we're just maxing in the studio. We're hailing from East Oakland, California, and sometimes it gets a little hectic out there. But right now, you know, we're gonna up you on how we just chill.
Down the seven digits, call up Bridget, her man's a midget. Plus, she got fridge, yo, I can dig it. Here's a 40 swigging, you know it's frigid. I got him chilling in the cooler, break out the ruler. Damn, that's the fattest dog I ever seen. The weather's heat in Cali, getting weed, it makes it feel like Maui. Now we feel the good vibration. So many females, so much inspiration.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I am your host, Pierce Redman, and you can find all of my work by going to porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. Okay, everybody, so I realize that we haven't had a podcast in the past couple weeks. I've been a little bit sick, but today's podcast is going to be a little bit of a doozy. There's a lot of information, and this is on a topic that I find really important. So I think we'll just get right into it. So we've got the war in Syria is still raging on. Violence in Libya is continuing and reaching a very terrifying point right now. And there is still this constant stream of pro-war, pro-West propaganda that is being propagated by just about, you know, everybody in the mainstream media and elsewhere. Now, this propaganda takes lots of different forms. But there is one character who I have been following for quite some time now, and I think he is very deeply involved, deeply ingrained in both the intelligence services and the media and whatnot. And this is a character by the name of Matthew Van Dyke. Now, I hope that some of the listeners already have a little bit of a idea about who this guy is, but for anybody who doesn't know, he is this journalist and not a journalist and a rebel fighter and not a rebel fighter, and you know, he goes back and forth on whatever he is, whatever benefits him at the moment. But he came to prominence in during the war in Libya. And he fought with the Libyans and was captured, and we're going to get into who this guy really is. But I thought first perhaps we could just listen to Matthew Van Dyke himself explaining who he is. And this is a short clip that comes from a Truthloader interview that they conducted with Van Dyke a few years ago. So we'll listen to this right now.
I'm an American citizen. For years, I spent time in North Africa and the Middle East. I have a master's degree in Middle East Security Studies from Georgetown University. I spent a few years traveling by motorcycle in the region, making a travel adventure documentary film. And I made a lot of good friends in the area. And when the Libyan revolution started, those friends started telling me about what was happening to them and their friends and their family. And I decided that I couldn't just sit at home and watch, so I went to help them. I fought in the revolution. I was captured by Gaddafi's forces. I spent nearly 6 months in prison. In solitary confinement, I escaped from prison and returned to the front lines and fought in the war until it was over. I engaged in a lot of fighting. I had around 40 engagements with the enemy. I kept notes on each one. Not all of those involved returning fire, but quite a few did. I fought as a Dushka gunner. Dushka is a heavy machine gun in a Jeep, which was driven by a Libyan friend of mine I've known since 2007. We didn't go and search buildings for body counts afterwards. I don't know. I don't know if I killed anyone or not. And now I'm working in Syria, helping the rebels with various things, propaganda, filming, helping with a lot of various things. I've chosen my side. I'm very clear about my side. I'm not objective. Well, in Libya, I had good friends, and they were all on the right side. So I was fighting for my friends. I think liberty is a universal concept, and that's what I'm fighting for. I don't see how anybody could side with an authoritarian regime. Most of my filming is autobiographical for years, the motorcycle adventure films. I filmed my life in the region for many years, and that's also what I did in Libya. Recently, I did a film that's an openly pro-revolution film in Syria. You know, what I am, I guess I'm an activist filmmaker. In my heart, I'm still a fighter. I'll probably fight in Syria in the future. But I'm definitely not a journalist. It's just a label that the press created for me when I was missing in Libya. I just spent, you know, $14,000 to $15,000 making a Syrian film of my own money. And I have very little likelihood of getting that money back and releasing the film for free. I'll try to release it on networks and get a little bit of money to cover my costs. But, you know, it's I pretty much put everything into this. You know, I did a business deal in Iraq many years ago that gave me some money. I made some money when I was in Iraq teaching English. I have a small amount of money that was an inheritance that's run out now. Pretty much I'm broke now. But, you know, every time I run out of money, something comes along and I keep yelling. But, you know, my finances are quite poor. Many, many years ago, about a decade ago, I was offered a conditional employment offer by the CIA back when I was in graduate school. And at that time, I thought about it and I decided not to. I have no desire to work for any government right now. I prefer to remain independent. I have no association with Jalit al-Nusra. They're not part of the FSA. They're an independent group who's also fighting against Assad. You know, as long as they shoot in the right direction at Assad soldiers, it doesn't bother me or anybody else really right now.
Okay, so Matthew Van Dyke is a quote, freedom fighter. You know, he went and fought with the Libyans. He is not a journalist. He is a propagandist. Interesting title to name yourself as. And he has no association with Jabhat al-Nusra. Although it's fine that they're, you know, even though that they are Al-Qaeda affiliated and, you know, doing horrific things because they're going after the right bad guy, in this case, Assad. Well, all of these statements are things that Van Dyke routinely uses when describing himself. As I said, not a journalist. He was approached by the CIA, not the other way around. And all of these are distortions and lies. And as we'll see later on, Van Dyke is a much more complicated and a much darker character than that short interview portrayed him as. Now, let's dig a little bit deeper. And first off, we can just go to his own website, which is matthewvandyke.com. And throughout the website, he refers to himself as a former journalist. You know, you can go around his website, you can find the pictures that he took when he was embedded in various army units, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. He refers to himself as a journalist. So right off the bat, we've got a little something there. But to dig a little bit deeper, and to again go with Matthew Van Dyke's own words, because I think sometimes that's really important, is to, you know, see what they actually say about themselves. He wrote a pretty lengthy piece for the Huffington Post back in 2012. And this article is entitled "How Osama Bin Laden Changed My Life." And I'd really urge everybody to go and read the full article. It's a little bit long, so I'm not going to be able to get into every little detail about it. But in it, he lays out a pretty detailed description of his life since college and how Bin Laden affected him and how all of these events have sort of shaped his life. Now, he attended Georgetown University. And he was part of the Foreign Service School Department or whatever. He studied the Middle East. And, you know, right in the very beginning of this, he mentioned September 11th and how this shaped his mind. And he had been thinking about working for the CIA back in 2001. And he says that 9/11 really kind of thrusted him into this idea. So he goes and applies for a job position. It wasn't, you know, the CIA approaching him. He goes, he passes the initial interview, but fails the polygraph exam, and eventually doesn't really end up retaking it. Now, it's important to note that early on in this, when he's talking about joining the CIA and how he wants to go and, you know, hunt down Bin Laden and whatnot, he also claims to be active in the anti-war movement in terms of Iraq. Now, you might be thinking, you know, why would someone join the CIA but be against the war in Iraq and whatnot? And Van Dyke explains that he's not against overthrowing Saddam, he's merely against U.S. boots on the ground. He instead thinks that an option like the one that we took in Libya is better, whereby we fund the insurgents and provide them air support. So already kind of an interesting, weird sort of a take on this whole thing. Now, he sort of, you know, is in America, he's sort of going back and forth, he's, you know, claiming to go to these anti-war meetings, but still very passionate about killing everybody in Afghanistan. Then he, in 2007, begins this epic journey, and it's this the journey across North Africa and eventually ending up in Afghanistan that I think is really the key to understanding who Van Dyke is and what his real agenda is. So as I say, in 2007, he lands in Morocco. He's sort of hangs around there for a while, driving around on his motorcycle. Which is, you know, he's always talking about that. He ends up helping smuggle cars in Mauritania, not sure what that's about. And then in 2008, he pays a bribe to get a visa to go to Libya, and he travels across Libya on a motorcycle. And it is then where he makes all of these contacts that we heard him referring to in that previous clip. He eventually gets kicked out of Libya. I can't imagine why. And then drives from Libya to Egypt, to Jordan, to Syria, then to Turkey, and then finally into Iraq. Now, just to pause there for a second, that's a pretty long trip for a single American who doesn't really know the lay of the land. Yes, he studied the Middle East in college, but I mean, that doesn't necessarily prepare you to travel across North Africa by yourself on a motorcycle. So already, you know, I would be a little bit suspicious of who this person is, who doesn't work for the CIA, definitely doesn't work for the CIA. Well, when he arrives in Iraq, according to this Huffington Post article, he says that after seeing the, quote, freedom and optimism of a surprising number of Iraqis, my views on the war change, and I now support the Iraq war. So I suppose that the daily car bombings, political assassinations, kidnappings, things like that, you know, those are just, it's so free and everyone is so optimistic that his, you know, complete, you know, viewpoint changes on the Iraq war. Now, in 2009, while he's in Iraq, he becomes a war correspondent and embedded journalist covering the Iraq war that I had once so passionately opposed. And during his time in Iraq, he is embedded with this army unit. He is a journalist. I believe he was at that point working for the Baltimore Examiner, which no longer exists today. But as he said, he is a journalist. Now, I find this, again, a little bit odd that this American guy, who seemingly is, quote, not a journalist, winds up in Iraq on the back of a motorcycle and just sort of goes into an army unit and becomes embedded. That's just really not done that well. I mean, they really want to vet these people. They want to make sure that they're portraying the war in a positive light. But, you know, we'll get to more of that later. And while he's in Iraq, he's also routinely arrested by the Iraqi police. He's accused of being a terrorist and a spy. And this happens multiple times, as he points out in this article. And every single time, he is released either by the State Department or by the U.S. military. And there's seeming no repercussions. No one is telling him, perhaps be a little bit more careful. Perhaps, you know, you're going to the wrong neighborhoods or whatever. It doesn't really happen. And again, he also peppers much of this article with these little quotes about, oh, you know, I can't believe we've been here for this long and they're still torturing people and kidnapping people, you know, oh, God. But I'm still optimistic about Iraq's future. I'm sure that this military occupation is going to turn out just fine. Now, it's around 2010 that the Van Dyke story begins to take another level and I think really enters into this pseudo-world between journalism and spying. And this is when he meets up with another American photographer, and they decide to drive their motorcycles from Iraq to Afghanistan. Now, of course, they have to go through Iran to do this, and they're going to be filming themselves while they do this, and they hope to meet up with an army unit in Afghanistan and become embedded with them. Now, just pause for a second and think about this. This is a guy, a supposed journalist, who is going to just enter into Iran with another American on motorcycle, drive across this country, and then reach Afghanistan. Now, yes, I mean, people can do this, but again, this is not something that you just sort of haphazardly decide to do. You know, you don't just drive through Iran without any sort of contacts, without any knowledge of the language or whatnot. And to top this all off, the Iranian press, the Fars News Agency, just before they entered into Iran with American passports on the back of the motorcycles, Iran had just accused them of being American spies. So again, a bit odd that you can just sort of do this, but somehow, and he doesn't go into any of the specific details of this, but they cross Iran, you know, no problem. Now, in the fall, winter of 2010, according to this article, they reach Afghanistan, where they dodge armed bandits and kidnappers and are arrested by the Afghan police a few times. They also say that it's so dangerous to travel through Iran that they dress up, to travel through Afghanistan, they dress up like Afghanis, and they just carry some concealed sawed-off shotguns for protection. Again, two Americans dressed as Afghans driving around on motorcycles with sawed-off shotguns doesn't really conjure up the image of your typical journalist. Somehow, though, they survive through this. And in certain articles, Van Dyke will claim that he pretended to be Icelandic because no one knew where Iceland was, and it seemed like a safe, neutral country. Again, I mean, he's walking around, I'm assuming, with an American passport, if he's just an American journalist. But it doesn't really go into very many details about this. He, again, just shows up and gets embedded with another army unit. So, he is, for all intents and purposes, acting as a journalist, despite the fact that Van Dyke claims he never was one, as we heard in that clip. Again, he complains about the Afghan security forces and the fact that they're imprisoning American journalists on motorcycles and, oh, how horrible. Never really mentions that, if you think it's bad for American journalists, I mean, imagine being an Afghan journalist. Now, before he leaves Afghanistan, this is one that is just priceless. He sneaks into Osama bin Laden's destroyed house in Jalalabad and plants an American flag in the ruins to honor all the Americans who gave their lives fighting bin Laden and his followers in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, that's important because here's this man who's saying that he wants to commemorate the lives of people who fought al-Qaeda. So let's just keep that in mind, and we're going to return to that later. And we'll just sort of sum this up right now. In March 2011, he returns to America, but at this point the Arab Spring is sort of underway, and his friends, his contacts that he made in Libya, say, oh my God, we need your help. Come and fight as a freedom fighter in the revolution. Now, Van Dyke ostensibly tells his mother and a few other people that he's going to work as a journalist in Libya. He goes to Libya, is shortly captured on a reconnaissance mission. He spends about 5 months as a POW in solitary confinement in Abu Salim prison, which is a pretty horrific place to go. Later on, he escapes in some massive prison break, which he never really goes into much detail about, although I'll post a few things up in the show notes from his website describing this. He quickly returns to the front lines. Now, this is, again, against the better judgment of Human Rights Watch, who had been trying to get him released, again, under the impression that he was a journalist, and as well as the Committee to Protect Journalism. They were trying to get him out as well, and they later denounced him completely as a liar and a fraud. But anyway, he goes back and he fights, as he said, until Gaddafi is brutally executed. And I really urge everybody to just read the very last parts of this Huffington Post article, because in it, I mean, he goes into this, you know, talking about how this was all worth it, and that, you know, now the public is so war weary after Iraq and Afghanistan that they're opposed to any military action in support of the Arab Spring. They're even opposed to the very idea of overthrowing the sorts of regimes that, you know, we spend all this money getting rid of in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he has a snide little remark about how, oh, you know, it's so ironic that I wanted to work for the CIA, but I didn't, and now everyone accuses me of being in the CIA. How funny. And he ends the article by saying, the bin Laden decade sure was strange. Well, yes, Matthew, it was quite strange, and so was this whole official story of him. I don't want to dwell on this too much right now because we've got a lot of other ground to cover, but just the whole idea that this guy just goes without knowing anybody, travels across North Africa, travels across Iran, I mean, that's pretty difficult to do, I would think. Drives around Afghanistan with guns on him, embedding himself with military units, all very odd. And by the time that this Huffington Post article was written, this is when Van Dyke mania was in full swing. He had been released from Libya, and he had eventually returned home. He was, you know, featured in like every major news outlet wanted to talk with him. He was being interviewed left and right about what it was like, and he begins to craft this sort of counterculture image of himself and begins the process of distancing himself from journalism. So in almost all of the interviews that he conducts after he returns from Libya, he claims to have never been a journalist. He claims he wasn't doing any journalism there. He was indeed a freedom fighter. Pictures of him, he's this like bearded hipster on a motorcycle carrying like an AK-47. A lot of the articles talk about how he loves skateboarding and this and that. There's a one particular article that's, it's, again, very revealing of who Van Dyke is. Was an article in Vice magazine, which just had a field day with this guy. You know, he was everything they wanted, the cool hipster who went and fought with the cool rebels in Libya. And in this article, this Vice article, he talks about his love of all people, John McCain. So not quite the kind of counterculture image that one would think. You know, he talks about how McCain is, you know, so great, and he's so, you know, he's always, he doesn't flip-flop, he's, you know where he stands. Very odd. And again, you know, he's crafting this whole image. And in the City Paper, which is a Baltimore-based newspaper, he said, "I accept the label of former journalist because people tell me I am. But it's flimsy. It's not like I ever made a living. I actually just spent money doing it." So, okay, so I guess, you know, if you make, you know, if you don't make money, then it's not journalism. So I guess, you know, what I do, what a lot of other people do in the alt media, that's not really journalism because we're not making any money off of it. So odd choice of words. But, and I just want to point out again, all of this time that he's in Libya, he never really mentions Al-Qaeda. He doesn't mention the fact that, you know, there are genocidal acts being carried out against black Libyans. He, you know, never goes into any of the minutiae, none of the complexities of this whole thing. Instead, he crafts this very choreographed image of the, you know, gallant rebels fighting against the monstrous Gaddafi. And it doesn't go into the fact that, you know, I mean, they were murdering people left and right. And that the fact now that the country is in complete and utter chaos. And again, as I say, he makes this big deal about bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda fighters, but never mentions the fact that lots of the people he was probably fighting with in Libya were affiliated with him. And as you saw in that Truthloader interview, he says that, well, as long as they're fighting the right bad guys, I don't really care. So yeah, sure, they could be Al-Qaeda people, they might want to behead every infidel, but as long as they you know, behead the right ones, then I guess it's fine. And just another little quick thing that I found interesting you know, you got to read through these mainstream news articles and really look for details. But in that Baltimore City Paper one where, again, they every 5 seconds they're talking about how he loves skateboarding and he's so counterculture and, you know, everyone at Georgetown thought he was a weirdo because he had a beard and whatnot. And buried in this article is a part where he's talking about after being released from prison in Libya, he was a machine gunner, and that was his primary function when he was fighting with the rebels. And they mount this DSHK 50 caliber machine gun on the back of a Jeep, and Van Dyke and I guess the others don't really know what to do, so Van Dyke ends up calling a family friend who could just help him, you know, give him some advice on how to use this. So again, I don't know very many skateboarding bearded hipsters who love John McCain and have family friends who know how to fire 50 caliber machine guns. Now, Van Dyke rose to even greater prominence in 2013 when he traveled to Syria to make a propaganda film. Now, again, the notion that this guy went and fought in Libya, which by all intents and purposes would be against the law here in America. You're not, you know, you can't just go and fight in a foreign country. But again, no repercussions. He then goes to Syria, and he makes this film called Not Anymore, A Story of Revolution. And it's this 15-minute film starring a journalist of all people, even though, you know, Van Dyke is not a journalist, but a journalist called Noor Kells, who's a 24-year-old woman in Aleppo. Now, I mean, this movie is just completely... I mean, Van Dyke admits it's a propaganda film. It's extremely one-sided. You know, it goes into none of the context of what's really going on in Syria, and portrays basically all of the rebels as moderate and all of Assad's people as butchers. That's the bottom line. And it's 15 minutes, so, I mean, how much could you really learn in 15 minutes? Now, this film, I mean, skyrockets Van Dyke to even a higher degree of fame. He's won 33 awards for this movie, including one just a week ago. It's shown at every major film festival, from New York Film Festival to Tribeca, all over the place. It boosts his image. He is just that guy. You know, everyone knows Van Dyke. And, you know, and while this is all going on, I'll admit I have been berating him on Twitter. I, you know, constantly tweet at him. And a lot of the time he does respond. I mean, when I began following him in Libya, he instantly followed me back and, you know, sent me messages. And I have talked to him, albeit on Twitter, several times in the past. And when he returned back in about 2012, 2013, I remember tweeting him and saying, you're not a journalist, you're a mercenary. And he said, and I'll include this in the show notes, he said something to the effect of, I am not a journalist, but I'm not a mercenary, because when I fight, I don't get paid. So, very interesting. And again, let's just sort of remember that detail, because it's going to come back in a little while. But anyway, 2013, again, Van Dyke is on top of the world. His film is shown on CNN. It's streamed on The Guardian. It's just everywhere. And no one outside of a few people here and there in the alternative media are really kind of questioning, who is this guy? How does he manage to get these funds? How does he travel to these countries? He's fighting with various rebels. And no one really seems to question this. And again, I find this very odd, that even, you know, the mainstream media doesn't even, you know, just kind of hint at things, you know, like, how do you do this? How did you just go to Libya, make all these friends, come back, and then decide, oh, I'm going to go fight in a war? Very odd. Now, shortly after the film came out, there was a huge bombshell that was dropped on Van Dyke. And I thought that this would be a bigger deal. Because it really revealed lots of the lies and distortions that Van Dyke had been telling people. I am referring to the Syrian Electronic Army's hack of his email and Facebook accounts. Now, for anyone who doesn't know, the Syrian Electronic Army has been around for a couple years now, and they've actually been involved in a lot of very high-profile hacks. They've hacked the BBC, Associated Press, NPR, The Washington Post, Harvard, the U.S. Marine Corps, Human Rights Watch. They've done everything from sort of denial of service attacks to putting up the SEA logo on the screen, taking over people's Twitter accounts, putting out false tweets, things like that. Now, you know, it's important to note that when you're dealing with any of these shadowy anonymous hacker groups, that you've got to kind of wonder who they are. And I will admit that for a while, I thought that the Syrian Electronic Army was in fact some sort of State Department or CIA-funded organization, because they seem to only be going after, like, these mainstream newspapers, and you don't really know. I mean, it's like if you go into any of the history of Anonymous or Lulzsec or anything like that, I mean, it's filled with informers and agents, and they very well could be, you know, some guy sitting in Langley. I will say, though, that I think after the Van Dyke hacks, the Syrian Electronic Army kind of did show their colors, and they are probably some form of either pro-government group or Syrian government group, for that matter. But like I said, you know, we got to be careful with this. But I will say this, that when they published these very, very damning Facebook and email messages, Van Dyke and almost all the other people involved in this freely admitted that, yes, this is true. These are the accounts. And then at times they would say that they were a little bit altered, and that very well may be true. But the major thrust and the major stories that they revealed in these hacks have all been confirmed from the parties involved in this. And I would tend to agree that the Syrian Electronic Army is actually not some sort of government plant. And I would say that at least in this case, these hacks, I do lend quite a bit of credence to. So let's go into these, because this is really where the Van Dyke story reached this point where maybe you didn't really believe that he could have been working for the CIA, or he could have been some form of asset or something like that. These leaks really make it just so clear that this guy is really, there's a lot more to him. And they're just so damning that I thought these would make a bigger deal. But anyway, in these hacks, he talks with lots of different people who are very prominent in this whole pro-war, propaganda movement to bomb the shit out of Syria. And perhaps the most revealing of all is his knowledge that rebels had chemical weapons. And Matthew Van Dyke told this to multiple journalists, including the just scum of the fake journalism, whatever disinformation campaign, Elliot Higgins, who runs the Brown Moses blog. Now, anyone who doesn't know who Elliot Higgins is, he is this unemployed Englishman who sits at home and watches YouTube videos, supposedly from Syria, although, I mean, you know, how could you confirm any of these videos? It's very difficult to do that. And he has somehow become this sort of media darling. He writes for Foreign Policy. He is a consultant with Human Rights Watch right now. And this guy had no experience whatsoever with chemical weapons, with warfare, with any kind of weapons history at all. And he has slowly, he is like the go-to guy now. But anyway, Van Dyke and Higgins apparently knew each other. And back in May 8th of 2013, Van Dyke said, quote, "Don't rule out the possibility that the rebels do have a small quantity of chemical weapons. I've had information for a few months on this." Higgins replies, "Did you see my last post about Jabhat al-Nusra having one of those grenades?" Van Dyke, "This is, all caps, off the record. I am telling you, since you've done so much good work in this field, you have a right to know about the likelihood." Higgins, "I'll keep it off the record." Van Dyke further replies, "I have a source that has been reliable in the past who gave me information about the rebels having acquired a small quantity a few months ago, and I know what building they came out of, and I know some things about the building, having been to the site, that give the information some additional credibility." Higgins, "Did they mention what type?" Van Dyke, "The Syrian regime was openly contemplating the idea of letting inspectors into the Aleppo case for a reason." Now, this goes on, and they talk more and more about this, and basically Van Dyke is saying, well, this is just a safety issue, I'm just telling all journalists so that they know they could be exposed, blah, blah, blah. Now, what's important to note here is that Van Dyke told this to Higgins at least 5 or 6 months before the chemical attack in Ghouta, which was this huge false flag attack that was instantly blamed on Assad, which made no sense, obviously, I mean, for a number of reasons, aside from the fact that they couldn't have launched them, that the attacks came from within rebel territory. Why would Assad launch chemical weapons when he's got UN inspectors literally just a few miles away checking out for chemical weapons? But Higgins was the mainstream media's go-to guy to write this very idiotic hit piece on Seymour Hersh, who had just written a very well-detailed, very well-sourced intricate article all about how the not only was the intelligence faked by Obama, but that, you know, there were numerous other things that just did not jive together with the idea that Assad would launch a chemical attack. And then, of course, when these leaks came out, you know, Higgins went on and said, you know, oh, well, it was, you know, I don't really go from unconfirmed sources about things like that, even though this guy, all he does is watch YouTube videos. So I don't know how he's sourcing any of that. But like I said, you know, Higgins is, again, one of these very important propagandists, and you see him working with Van Dyke to create this narrative. And Higgins never in the article mentioned the fact that he had heard that the rebels might have had something. Again, he completely ignores it, and we just go with the straight, regular propaganda line. And later on in some of these leaks, we also have Elliot Higgins and Van Dyke talking about their mutual benefactor. And this is some sort of rich guy who donates to both Higgins and Van Dyke. And I only mention this because Higgins asks, oh, is he in Washington? And Van Dyke says, yes, in the D.C. area, in Virginia, near D.C. Now, I mean, it could just be some guy in Virginia, but of course we all know Langley, Virginia is the home of the CIA. We're talking about a mutual benefactor. And just to stay on Elliot Higgins for one more minute, because I think he is really, I mean, we could do a whole podcast on him and how much of a phony he is, and I'll provide some really good criticism and some really good articles on Higgins and just his whole story. Later on in another Facebook conversation, and this one dates to around February 13th, 2013, Van Dyke and Higgins are talking about job prospects and, you know, making money and blah, blah, blah. And Van Dyke says, oh, yeah, I heard you're working for Human Rights Watch. Higgins is saying, yeah, you know, it's good. I'm writing reports. And then Higgins says that he just got a very interesting job offer, so it might be really worth it to take it. Van Dyke says, cool, what? Higgins, a counterterrorism company has invited me over to discuss opportunities in relation to open source intelligence gathering. Might include sponsorship or even a job. Van Dyke, oh, that is great. Van Dyke again, like a Stratford-type company? Higgins, Allen Vanguard. They manufacture EOD gear and bomb detection stuff, as well as produce intelligence reports. Lots of government contracts, stuff like that. Allen Vanguard is, simply put, a military contractor, a mercenary company. Yes, they do provide anti-IED training and things like that, but they also provide security for foreign governments, counterintelligence work, counter-espionage, things like that. So this man who works for Human Rights Watch is also working for a military contracting unit. Again, very strange and very revealing of this little, you know, clique of people who are sort of in the background of these, you know, the Syrian war, the Libyan war, and they're very influential, and you can see that they're not quite who they claim to be. Just a quick note, it's very funny earlier that, you know, Van Dyke and Higgins are talking about some sort of mutual benefactor who could be in the CIA, and Higgins was one of these people who accused Assad Abu Khalil, who runs the Angry Arab News Service, of working for the CIA. So, you know, just a side note right there. Now, you know, like I said, there's a lot in these hacks, so I would really urge everybody to go through them. But I'll try and point out just a few more that I think are really important and put this whole thing into context and really describe who Van Dyke is and what his agenda is. Now, he talked to a friend, Dylan Connor, who is some sort of protest singer who I believe even performed at the White House singing songs about Syria. And I'll just paraphrase these, but essentially Van Dyke warns him that, yes, I've had information that for a couple of months now that rebels have acquired a small quantity of chemical weapons. He says, quote, this is Van Dyke, the rebels would likely fire on their own people knowing that their deaths would be worth it if it led to U.S. intervention. It would be an acceptable cost to trigger international intervention. Their deaths could save hundreds of thousands of lives if it worked. Assad has nothing to gain from chemical weapon use. He is already winning the war. So, I mean, again, the, you know, I guess I mention these things only because it's very easy to be swayed by these horrific images, especially from Ghouta, where you had just rooms full of dead children who had been gassed to death. But there, you know, and then you have these characters like Van Dyke coming on and saying how evil Assad is, and you know, he's admitting the fact that sure, the rebels would do this. It makes perfect sense because they know that it'll trigger an intervention. And on top of that, he says, "Oh, but and it would be worth it too." So very sick, and it really kind of turns my stomach. He also told other people. He told Time Magazine's Steven Sotoloff, freelance journalist Balint Slanko, that, bring a gas mask. I heard that the rebels have chemical weapons, and both of them are like, wow, isn't that crazy? And not once ever when writing about Syria did they mention this fact. Let's move on a little bit to the really kind of damning information that I think is here. And that is that Van Dyke totally works with Al-Qaeda. He mentions that he needs to find someone who can get him in contact with al-Nusra, because that's the most important contact to make. And as we, you know, in the Truth Loader interview, Van Dyke expressly said, "I have no association with al-Nusra." Whereas according to these Facebook messages, I mean, he's working very hard to make a connection there. He talks about the fact that, of course, Al-Qaeda is in Libya, and that if they weren't there, you know, then the everything would just be, you know, would fall apart. He talks about how he doesn't want to say no to the jihadis because they're important connections for me. And then later on, he even says, quote, "The fact is, if it wasn't for foreign fighters and Jabhat al-Nusra, we'd be in serious shit right now militarily." But I mention this only because he makes this huge deal about, you know, honoring all of those people who fought and died fighting al-Qaeda in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then he's going and meeting, he's setting up contacts, he totally supports them. And again, who does that? I mean, that's very, very CIA, very intelligence security service sort of angle. You know, the average American who wants to go and fight doesn't really think that al-Qaeda is super cool. You know, and as I said, there's a lot more in these, and I think there's really only, you know, two more that are very important. One of these is an email that he wrote in 2012, and this one is really important because in this email, he talks about getting back into the military contracting business. He says that, you know, he's got some people that he is, you know, looking to talk with, and that he, you know, thinks this is a great idea. Now, he, and the subject line is military contracting in Libya and elsewhere. As I said, this is from May 8th, 2012. Now, I mention this because Van Dyke personally told me on Twitter in 2013 that he's not a mercenary because he doesn't get paid. Where, you know, and just a year ago, he is talking with someone called Johnny Rico all about getting involved in the military contracting business. He refers to some American and Italian ex-military guys that he could help bring over and set up contacts with. I mean, this guy is just such a phony and such a liar, but he has this tremendous amount of influence over lots and lots of people. And then finally, also in 2012, he sends a Facebook message to somebody whom he helped to acquire an application, a visa, from the Libyan embassy. And I'll just read you this, because this one is, again, very, very important. "Please mention that I wrote a letter to go with your application to the embassy that helped you get a visa more quickly, and that I know the Libyan ambassador personally, as well as government officials in Libya, and am extremely well-connected. What would really be helpful to me personally, though, I might be asking too much of you to include it also, is you propose that I be welcome to join Vulture Club because I'm working as a journalist again now and am very well connected in Libya and elsewhere and would be a great resource for Vulture Club members." Now, Vulture Club is this sort of informal group of war correspondents. But there he is. I mean, saying that now I'm working as a journalist again, you know, and please do tell everybody that I'm doing this. And as I said, I mean, this is after the, you know, CPJ you know, just, I mean, flew off the handle, rightfully so, saying that, you know, this guy was pretending to be a journalist. We tried to get him out of Libya, and then he went back and fought with the rebels. And CPJ says, you know, that makes it that much more likely that the next time a real journalist gets picked up and says, no, I'm not a spy, I'm not working with them, they're not going to believe him. So, again, I mean, Van Dyke is just full of contradictions, full of lies, and you do wonder what's really going on here. Now, I'll try and wrap up these leaks, and we'll get to a little bit more critical analysis on all of this, what this really means. But of course, nothing would be complete without the obligatory sex scandal, and again, Van Dyke is up to his eyeballs in that. And now, the main one involves Noor Kells, who is the star of his Syrian propaganda film. And of course, in the movie, Noor Kells is, you know, she's this cool young woman who's just, you know, fighting for freedom. And but it turns out that there's also a sex tape of her floating around Syria. She panics and contacts Van Dyke and says, we've got to do something about this. And she asks Van Dyke first, can you kidnap the guy who has the sex tape? And he says, no, I can't do that right now. But why don't you hire the FSA to kidnap him? And we could hold him ransom or torture him or whatever. So, you know, I don't think the sort of sex stuff is, you know, kind of who really cares. And there are much more salacious convos where he's talking with his girlfriend about the orgies that they have, and he's extremely crude in all of these, and I'm not really going to go into them. You know, he talks about getting some girl pregnant, and it's just like, I mean, he sounds like a 16-year-old kid. You know, I think it's important just to note them, just, you know, the idea that they would kidnap someone, because this guy had a sex tape of this woman, it just sort of goes towards, damaging this very wholesome image of the rebels and whatnot, you know, that they're just all wonderful people, and they're going around making sex tapes and whatnot. And I will mention, just before we finish up here, there is another aspect of these SEA leaks, and I don't really know what to make of them. I'm not sure. I'm referring to this guy, Austin Bodetti, who is like a, I don't know, he must be 18 or 19 years old, and he has these conversations with Van Dyke, and these are the ones that are the most sort of bizarre. And I find them probably to be the most edited or altered in any way. And I don't know how much that is, but a lot of them are just Bodetti talking and Van Dyke having no response. And this guy is weird. First off, he's like 18, 19 years old. He seems to have this like intimate knowledge of CIA weapons smuggling operations, as well as like Turkish intelligence contacts. Now, in some of these, Van Dyke does respond back to him and does, you know, give him advice on certain things and, you know, sort of the context of what's going on. Bodetti says in one of these messages, you mentioned friends in the CIA. We should get into more detail on that. I don't know who the hell this guy is. I mean, there are pictures of him online. You can, if you, you know, simply put his name in a search engine, you will find lots of comments on various websites where he's talking about the need, to, you know, get more involved, and we've got to send more arms, and we've got to send, in troops to fight and whatnot. And he seems to be a real actual person. But just to add, just the most bizarre sort of, you know, throw on this and maybe get all the conspiracy people a little more interested in the story. Where does Austin Bodetti come from? Where does he live? None other than Newtown, Connecticut. And in some of the comments and things that I've found of him on various websites, he even refers to the Newtown, Connecticut shooting, and saying that, you know, those things happen every day in Syria. And, you know, so we need to get involved. So, you know, make of that what you will. Like I said, you got to take all of these things with a little bit of a grain of salt. But I'll also throw in a pretty good video that Syrian Girl did on Van Dyke when these leaks first came out. And she includes lots of Facebook messages and comments that Van Dyke had, basically saying that, yes, what's in these is true, but all they're going to find are just my dirty sense of humor. I think we've sort of gone into that. So perhaps now, in sort of summing this up, why is this important? Why am I so concerned with this? Well, first and foremost is that this kind of propaganda has got to stop. It's just so dangerous. I mean, we've got just the other day released audio from various Turkish high-level officials, including the foreign minister, talking openly about creating some sort of false flag attack in Turkey that would justify the Turks going in and invading Syria. And Syria many times will be sort of front page news and everyone will be talking about it, and then it kind of, you know, dissipates. It kind of goes and sort of falls into the background. And this is very dangerous because what's happening in Syria will have the just reverberations throughout that region and throughout the world. Syria really is, you know, extremely important to the structure of the Middle East, and a war there, a full, you know, NATO-led war or whatever would, I really just can't even imagine. It would just be so horrific. And furthermore, you know, the alt media really needs to do more in exposing things like this. We spend a lot of time accusing one another of being disinfo agents and working for COINTELPRO and the like. And we totally forget that there are real actual disinfo agents out there. And they have a much larger platform with which to propagate lies and deceptions, and we don't really do enough to in exposing them. I mean, you know, you'll see it here and there, but I mean, this Van Dyke character has been around forever. He's very public, and the fact that no one outside of a few people here and there who wrote articles, as I said, Syrian Girl has been sort of into him, you know, we don't see a lot about that, and I find that really sad and disconcerting. And alt media in general needs to do more actual, like, investigating into who these people are. You know, you've got to really look at this and not just sort of regurgitate, he's just a, you know, Zionist CIA agent or something like that. The most important thing here is that Van Dyke is part of this, as I said, this clique of sort of media, CIA, mercenary type people who really go towards glorifying war and making it look romantic and fun. And as I said, he crafted this very well done image of himself as this cool, young, hip guy who just drove around on a motorcycle with an AK-47 strapped to his back, and he wanted to go and fight and blah, blah, blah. He freely admits that he has no problem with war. And that is what I find the most disgusting and the most dangerous thing here, because he really helps to frame the whole, be it the war in Syria, the war in Libya, or just war in general, as a good versus evil sort of a situation. However you want to frame it, even if you're quote-unquote on the good side or, you know, fighting the just war, you're still murdering people. And in my book, I just can't really accept that as justified anytime. So no matter what, even if you're fighting the good fight, you are murdering, you are killing people, human beings. And that is the most counterproductive way to bring about change. There were people that fought, on the German side in World War II who were, you know, that's what they had to do. They were either drafted or they felt they wanted to defend themselves, and, you know, they went and did that. And that doesn't mean that they're all horrific, evil people, and that butchering them, you know, burning them and killing them is somehow justified. And the same thing is true in Syria. Yes, there are horrific things being done, on Assad's behalf, but, you know, there's a lot of just regular people who are in the Syrian army who are simply doing what they think is right. These could be 18-year-old kids who don't, they have no necessarily political allegiance outside of the fact that I'm in the Syrian army and I want to defend my country. And what they're, you know, and to go and murder them doesn't make that good or justified. And I think that Van Dyke is one of these propaganda CIA disinfo agents. And I think that, yes, that is without a doubt true. I think if you go through his history, as we just did, I mean, there's no way that this guy who goes to Georgetown is approached by the CIA, but doesn't pass his polygraph, so he never really applies again, and then somehow goes and travels across from Morocco to Afghanistan with no real problems along the way, then goes and fights in Libya and is able to promote this propaganda film. I mean, that is someone in the CIA. And I don't know to what degree. Could he be a full-blown agent? Sure. Could he be some sort of asset? I think that's maybe a bit more likely. But, you know, as I was saying, he romanticizes war. He makes it look cool. He romanticizes spy work. And that is very destructive to a free society. War is the most destructive thing that a state can engage in, and it's the most destructive thing to people, obviously physically, but psychologically, you know, mentally. It destroys people who are genuinely good people. And I think that for the most part, those fighting in Syria, you know, even on the rebel side, I mean, there are just sort of regular people who are defending themselves. But then you get these, you know, you get these other elements that are infiltrating and circumventing, and it's very obvious that Al-Qaeda is all over Syria. I mean, is that really what this revolution is about? And and I think Van Dyke and people like Noor Kells, the subject of his movie, you know, they also go towards portraying revolution as this wonderful thing, and this is something that I've spoken about before on the podcast and with other people. You know, a revolution is just that. It's just starting in point A and ending in point A. And to think that some sort of violent overthrow of Assad and having Al-Qaeda have a huge base of operations there, I mean, you know, that's not really change. That's nothing. or, you know, if anything, I mean, that's worse. And, I mean, look at Libya. I mean, what has really changed? Or, for that matter, Egypt. I mean, nothing has changed. It's still the military in power. And I fear that in Syria, it's reaching a point where, you know, we wouldn't even have some sort of a strong man in power. It would probably look a lot more like Libya, which is this fractured nation with no real law and order to speak of, and people still dying in huge numbers. So, you know, I realize we've been talking now for about an hour, and you know, I think we'll leave it there. But as I said, you know, it's really important to expose these people. It's really important to pay attention when these random people, these seemingly random people, are sort of thrust into the spotlight. And it's important to really look deeper at this and look beyond just the headlines and look beyond just the alternative media headlines. Because if you're just going to say, oh, well, he's just a Zionist spy, I mean, that's not really telling you anything. You know, you've really got to do a little bit more work. And I do hope that happens, because I see that happening more and more right now, especially geopolitically. I mean, the alt media has really kind of dropped the ball. And as I said, there are events happening right now on the ground in Syria that are extremely important to take notice of. And I will go out on a limb here and make a little bit of a speculation, but I think that there is something very big that is about to happen in Syria. I think it's going to involve Turkey. I think it's going to involve NATO as a whole. And I think that people like Van Dyke are very integral in pushing whatever that narrative is going to be. Van Dyke, Higgins, a lot of these people. But Van Dyke is the one who I really can't stand. And just to leave it there, I tweeted out yesterday that the podcast today would be all about exposing Van Dyke as a CIA mercenary. And he responded back to me, thank you for announcing that. I will have my attorney ready to, you know, file a defamation suit. Now, I don't know if he's being serious or not. But Matthew, if you're listening to this, then please do, try and file some defamation suit, because I don't think I said anything that wasn't true. I quoted you mostly from your own words and from your own conversations. So if you think that is grounds for defamation, then go right ahead. Well, I think we'll leave it there. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. As I said before, I'm really sorry that I haven't had anything out again in like 2 weeks. I was very sick, but I'm going to be, you know, we're getting back onto the regular schedule. Hopefully every week we'll have a new podcast. I just want to say a couple mentions on the War Tax Resistors podcast. I got a lot of really excellent feedback, and I'm so glad, particularly a really nice email from a guy named Nathaniel. And I hope you're listening to this one as well, and thank you so much for the kind words. Hopefully, we're going to be speaking with Ruth Benn, who is the head of the National War Tax Resisters Coordinating Committee. You know, as I said before, she was just excellent and so awesome about everything. I will be appearing on Aaron Franz's show very soon, this coming week. So please do look out for that. And I'll just quickly right here mention that we're working on a new series here, and it's going to be revolving around sci-fi and science fiction in general. And I'll have a little bit more about that later. But as I said, I really thank everybody for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please do go to porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. There you can follow us through the RSS feed. You can always follow me on Twitter, at Porkins Policy. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/1138Porkins. And the best thing that you can do is if you enjoy the podcast, if you enjoy any of the podcasts or any of the writing that I do, then please share it with your friends, email it, put it on your social media, or simply tell people about it. That, you know, that always works, and that's a really big help to me. And I thank everybody so much who has been helping and spread the word about this show. So with that, I think we'll leave it there, and I will be talking to you very soon. It's your boy, Mr. Fab, man. The yellow bus rider, man. Sean T, the real king of slaps, man. Y'all better act like y'all know who he is, man. Yeah. Me give y'all a one-on-one on how to ghost ride. Look, the streets know just what this is. Ghost riding whip up and down the street. The Ghostbusters, they the police. Always want to pull a nigga over for his pee. Not me. You know where I'm going, in the north to the east, just in case you ain't knowing, baby. A town politics hit the club like Ben, tryna holler at a chick. Can't get in the club, got a parking lot pimp. Hey, little mama, come holler at a pimp. What you know about? Give you a whip, buy yourself some shoes, and then your car kicks. Ice up your neck, your hands and your whip, just to hang out the window, stunting with your clip. When you get a new car, and you're feeling like a star. Okay, okay, what you gonna do? Now let's go slide.